Hello, and welcome to the Modernizing Your Practice podcast series brought to you by CPA.com. CPA.com is the technology subsidiary of the AICPA and is tasked with helping bring the profession forward into the digital age through relevant learning opportunities and technology solutions. I am your host, Stephen Menjez, and I lead the Modernizing Your Practice part of the Assurance Services team at CPA.com. Our goal with this podcast series is to bring relevant and actionable insight to accounting firms around ways that you can modernize your firm in the context of today's most common areas of liability and risk. With me today is Laura Lapidus, an employment attorney and the Management Liability Risk Control Director at CNA Insurance, and Timothy Dominic, principal at Jackson Lewis PC, which is one of the country's preeminent workplace law firms. Laura and Tim, before we get into employment practices liability risk, tell us a little bit about your background and experience working with employment law and risk.
Thanks, Steve. I'm an employment attorney. I've worked in an employment litigation firm. I've actually been in-house counsel both on the government side and also for a private company, a restaurant company. After that, I went into the insurance business, and I spent about 10 years handling employment practices liability claims and other types of management liability claims for various carriers. And I've been in this position at CNA for about 10 years now, where my responsibility is really to assist our policyholders in managing employment risk.
Okay. And actually, Laura, tell us a little bit more about your company. What's for folks that aren't familiar with the company?
CNA provides insurance, all types of insurance. I focus on management liability, in particular employment practices liability insurance. And we provide that to all types of industries, particularly to accountants. We have a special program for our accountants with the AICPA.
Okay, great. Thanks for that. So how about you, Tim? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. Well, I spent my entire professional career working in labor and employment law firms. Initially, straight out of law school, I worked at a firm where I did both sides of the coin. I did plaintiff's work and defense work. So, you know, representing employees that had problems against their employers, and then, of course, representing employers when they had issues that they needed to be addressed. At this point now, I'm a principal at one of the nation's largest labor and employment law firms. All we do is management side labor and employment law. So we help employers of all sizes, you know, from the small mom and pop shops to the Fortune 100 companies, to, you know, address any of their employment needs, whether it be standard advice and counsel work, God forbid if you get there, straight through to the litigation.
Okay, great. Thanks for that, Tim. So, Laura, tell us a little bit about EPL employment practices liability and EPL risks in general today, kind of across all companies.
Well, employment practices liability insurance is a type of insurance that provides coverage not only for your damages, which would include settlements, or damages through a lawsuit or otherwise, but it also covers your defense costs for covered claims. And typically, it relates to employment-related claims such as wrongful termination, discrimination, harassment in the workplace, and of course, retaliation is covered as well under most of these policies. As far as the type of risks that we're seeing today, there's a lot of There's so much. The laws are changing so rapidly, but some of the top risks that we see, obviously sexual harassment has really been in the forefront over the past few years in light of the Me Too movement. So there's been a real spotlight on that. We're also seeing issues relating to pay equity. So there have been a lot of complaints about equal pay. Disability accommodation and discrimination and leave laws also there's a lot of issues that employers have to deal with relating to those topics. And those are the areas that a lot of employers get tripped up in because the laws are so complex. And then you've seen issues lately in the past year or two with marijuana in the workplace as it's been legalized and decriminalized in various states. However, it's still illegal under federal law. And then last but certainly not least is retaliation. And it's relatively easier to prove a retaliation claim, and I'll let Tim take it from there. But we see a lot of issues with respect to retaliation under various employment laws.
Yeah, and you know, just to bridge off of what Laura said, I mean, a lot of the claims that I wind up dealing with, and the firm in general winds up dealing with often, is retaliation claims. You know, when you have these types of employment-based situations where you have a problem with an employee or there's an issue that gets brought up, a lot of times an employer will handle the situation okay, not great, but okay. And then it also can lead to a potential retaliation risk. You know, as Laura says, it's its own standalone claim, which is can be very, very easy to prove at times, or at least easy enough to get to a jury. You know, it's causation, it's story, it's cause and effect. You know, somebody did something to me, so as a result, the employer reacted poorly and retaliated against me as a result.
Hmm. That's interesting. And I, you know, I had heard that before. I've studied EPL a little bit, and it's something I've been interested in because it really is a factor for every company, employment practices liability and kind of the things you guys talked about, discrimination in the workplace, sexual harassment. But that's one thing I did constantly hear was that that retaliation is pretty much always on the leaderboard, so to speak, and that's not a good leaderboard, that's a bad leaderboard, but that retaliation is always up there as something that unfortunately there are a lot of claims in that area. And it's interesting for you to say that it's actually fairly easy to prove retaliation as opposed to maybe some of the other areas.
Oh, yeah. You know, as far as how often that they get filed, even in 2019, the EEOC, you know, released their statistics for the year end of 2019. And in more than half of the cases that are filed, there's a retaliation component. And, you know, look, when I say that they're easier to prove, they're oftentimes easier to prove than a standard discrimination case because, you know, what could be considered discrimination or what could be considered harassment sometimes is, you know, within the eye of the beholder a little bit. But for retaliation, you know, the name of the game, if you're a plaintiff's attorney, is just get it past a judge to the point where you're going to get a jury trial. And then maybe you can convince 8 or 6 people that are sitting in a box that, hey, you know, if you went to your employer and you had a problem and they did to you what they did to me, how would you feel? And it's an emotional component.
Hmm. Yeah, that is interesting. If you kind of think about that, taking it forward to, you know, getting it in front of a jury, because I think most people have probably experienced or know someone that's experienced an issue at work where they kind of reported something and didn't necessarily get what they felt was an appropriate response from management. I also thought it was interesting earlier, Laura, when you mentioned that leave, that basically, you know, with the changes in leave policies that companies have, that you're seeing, you know, EPL activity around leave. Is that like, are you talking about like family leave or what type of leave are you talking about?
Usually, I mean, family medical leave, and there are some state statutes as well, you know, now that those are being enacted. So, you know, they tend to be complicated issues, especially, you know, for smaller firms that may not have the expertise on the human resources side to deal with some of the issues that are presented in that context. You know, obviously, you know, for family medical leave under the federal law, you're talking about, you know, larger employers. But, you know, new leave laws being passed, it's something, you know, that employers need to keep an eye on.
No, and that makes sense, and I think it's one of those things where if a firm is smaller, they've never really had anyone attempt to use these leave policies. Some of these policies are newer, and in some cases, a smaller firm, even if the, you know, if their state had a family leave policy, you know, their firm may be small enough that no one ever tried to use it before. So it's kind of a new thing for them. So I can definitely see that. So now thinking about CPA firms, what are some unique factors around EPL that are impacting CPA firms?
Well, I think when you look at CPA firms, you know, some of the issues that come up are that there are high wage earners involved. So if you have a high wage earner, that's going to impact your damage calculation and the potential for damages. The other thing we see with respect to CPA firms, and to some extent other firms like law firms, or are in the harassment arena, if someone's being harassed by a rainmaker, you know, if you have any type of issue, whether it's harassment or otherwise, where the person who is the alleged bad actor is a rainmaker, it's difficult for a firm to deal with it because that's the person bringing in their money. Unfortunately, a lot of times firms may be more lenient because the rainmaker is responsible for drumming up business, and there would be a loss of business if they disciplined or terminated that rainmaker. But if they don't, then they have employment risks to worry about. So, you know, we see that come up. I mentioned the pay equity issues. And one of the things that we see in claims, which is understandable, is that when you have a claim, whether there's a performance issue involved or some type of employment dispute, as you can imagine, most firms don't want to get their clients involved. You know, that they want to keep it in-house, which makes a lot of sense. But that what that leads to is you really have to have strong documentation. And I'm sure, as Tim will tell you, that goes for all companies. But especially where you don't want to have your clients testifying about, you know, an issue with a particular employee, it makes it even more important to make sure that you're documenting these types of issues, that you're able to provide backup documentation for the reasons for terminating or disciplining an employee.
How about you, Tim? Anything specific you're seeing just with regard to CPA firms in this area?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think part of the issues that, you know, small to mid-sized firms wind up dealing with when they have these types of problems is something that Laura mentioned, which is documentation. You know, a lot of firms, you know, they spend a lot of their time, you know, helping their customers, helping their clients, addressing problems, but perhaps losing sight of the back of the office type of HR component. So if they have a problem, you know, it's typically lack of experience on how to address it and how to deal with it. So maybe, you know, if an employee comes to you and they have an issue, you feel like you're addressing it by just talking to them. That's great. And that's all well and good, but where's the documentation? The reason why that's key is because in certain instances, if you have adequate documentation, and you have, unfortunately, wind up in litigation, there's a chance that you can potentially get the claim dismissed without getting to that jury, without having people making emotional decisions just based upon their own life experiences. So absolutely, documentation is key.
Okay. Well, that's good to know that there are things that firms can do to prevent getting to a litigation resolution there. I'd imagine that these type of things are especially relevant for CPA firms that are growing quickly, you know, both organically and through mergers or acquiring other firms. Some examples like that I see in my work with CPA.com is, you know, firms adding a new practice, right? Adding a client accounting services or CAS practice, or adding a SOC audit or cybersecurity audit practice, you know, where they're basically bringing in many new staff, oftentimes, you know, non-traditional hires, you know, people that, you know, hiring technologists into a firm to do cybersecurity cybersecurity audits or, you know, SOC audits and whatnot. So I guess like firms that are growing really fast, Laura, this would be even more applicable to them, correct?
Yes. And I think, you know, when you're adding different types of practices and bringing in, let's say, you know, more employees who are experts in cyber or other, you know, non-accounting type employees, you're dealing with different cultural backgrounds, different issues, you know, different expectations of, you know, of where they've worked in the past. And I think, you know, that all makes it more difficult for a smaller firm, because what used to be done casually, you know, when you're a small firm, your culture, it's all it's relatively casual. Things have to become more formalized as you grow, especially as you start bringing in different types of employees, like, you know, those who aren't accountants.
All right. Anything to add there, Tim?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly when you are doing non-traditional hires and you're getting different types of people, it's like any type of business, right? the more personalities in a room, the more likely there's a chance that there's going to be a problem down the road, which is why, you know, legal compliance, adequate training, the HR type of component in a company should always be addressed whenever a company grows.
Staffing up HR is typically not something that's at the top of the list for any organization that is looking to grow. So the burden on the HR staff is, you know, continues to increase, especially if you're doing a lot of hiring, and now you have a lot of these types of like I said, potential things that the firm isn't used to, that the HR department isn't used to. Personal story, my wife is a social worker, and she has worked with persons with developmental disabilities for much of her career. And kind of getting part of that is like getting them placed in the workplace and ensuring that they're kind of set up to succeed in the workplace. And, you know, for a lot of smaller companies and smaller law firms and accounting firms and other small businesses, you know, it may be the first time they've had someone with a disability, or, you know, is just basically different than what they're used to there. So, I know, Laura, you have access to liability claim data, both anonymized and actual. What can you tell us from the data? What is that telling us about EPL risk for CPA firms?
So looking just at the past 3 years, and this would be all different sizes of firms, but what we're seeing is that most of the claims involve terminations. The claim is filed when someone is fired. Obviously, they're upset they've lost their job. So it's usually, you know, I've been discriminated against when I was terminated, or that's when you'll get a sexual harassment claim, or you'll see allegations of disability discrimination. So for the most part, most of the cases that we have in the accountant's book do involve terminations, which just underlies the importance of making sure your documentation is accurate and that there is documentation to support your decisions, particularly when you're terminating someone. The types of claims that we're seeing are typical. Sexual harassment is one of the top ones. But interestingly, we also see disability discrimination or failure to accommodate a disability as one of the top allegations. And I think while everyone has spent a lot of time and effort trying to prevent harassment in the workplace, which is very important, I think some firms may have forgotten that there's other issues that have to be dealt with too, like disability discrimination, like accommodating someone with a disability. And I think, you know, this just illustrates that while sexual harassment is very important to focus on, that there's other areas in employment law that also firms need to pay attention to. And the third one that we see a lot, like we mentioned before, is retaliation. So I think that's pretty consistent, Tim, with what you see overall with respect to employers.
Absolutely. And I honestly couldn't agree with you more when you talk about, you know, how sometimes employers forget that there are other types of claims that are out there, right? I mean, certain jurisdictions have pushed over the past year and a half or so as a result of the Me Too movement to have mandatory sexual harassment training. And a lot of employers, even if they don't necessarily have a designated HR function within their business, will at least know enough to say, all right, we need to do this type of training. And they'll do the training and they check the box, and hopefully somebody gets something out of it as a result. But what we like to always tell our clients is, sexual harassment is absolutely important, but that type of training, use that as an opportunity. Train your staff on other issues. Talk to them about issues like disability discrimination, reasonable accommodations, the interactive process, that type of stuff. And at that point, it also sends a message to the staff that, look, we treat all these issues the same. We treat them all seriously enough.
No, that's a really good point. Does this, what you guys are just talking about, does that also apply to the interview process? Because I'm sort of thinking about, you know, with the increase in remote workers, for example, And again, growing firms doing a lot of interviewing now, perhaps doing a lot of interviewing and a lot of interaction electronically, remote with remote workers and whatnot. Does this also apply to the interview process? And is there a remote element?
Well, generally speaking, the EEO laws, you know, the anti-harassment, anti-discrimination, those types of laws, those apply in every single aspect of the employment relationship, whether it be interviewing, onboarding, certainly during the course of your employment, and you know, God forbid you get there, termination. The law applies at every single aspect.
Okay. Are you seeing any claims in that area, Laura? Are we seeing that, you know, are claims being made? Are there potential claims regarding the interview process?
I mean, we have seen that here and there, not so much on this book, but in general. You know, again, as things change, looking forward, I'm sure we can anticipate seeing a little bit more of that as well.
Okay. And how about, what do you see as things changing with more and more remote workers? Anything specific to that you can think of, Laura?
Well, I think just in general, it's more difficult for employers, especially if they haven't had a lot of teleworkers. It's more difficult just for managers to be running a team, to keep people engaged, to be able to review their work, you know, and to document deficiencies. I think that's just more of a challenge, at least initially. So I think, you know, there's going to be a little bit of a time for people to, you know, kind of ramp things up, and there's going to be a learning curve. But you know, that's one of the areas where managers need some training, I think. I think as we move to more teleworking, managers need to be trained in different ways to interact with their staff. And also, I think we have to be very cognizant of the fact that, you know, there could still be harassment and other types of employment issues. And those employees who are teleworking need to be trained, you know, with respect to anti-harassment, anti-discrimination laws, and make sure they also understand how to file complaints should they need to. You know, it's one thing when everyone's in the office, it's a little bit easier. So you have to make sure if they're teleworking that they understand how to do all that.
Yeah. And with telework, I mean, that can be, you know, can lead to a whole host of claims, right? I mean, you could have potential wage and hour violations. You could have claims of sexual harassment or even just telework in general, because apparently that's now the new norm. You know, there are going to be issues when it comes to disability discrimination, you know, even if and when, you know, the sudden influx of teleworkers eventually will be able to go back to their brick and mortar buildings. You'll have instances of employees coming forward saying, hey, I need an accommodation, you know, I for disability issues or otherwise. I'd like the opportunity to work from home occasionally. And employers are going to have to be prepared to address those issues.
No, and that makes sense. You know, I'm thinking myself, you know, for me to be able to work from home, I had to, you know, I had to have certain software installed. I had to sort of set up a different kind of workstation. All of that was provided for me at my office, but having to work remotely, that, you know, there were things that I needed in order to be successful at my job. So I can see that multiplied, especially for people with disabilities. So that makes sense. So Laura, the numbers, are you seeing, are there any numbers sort of stand out that you can talk about as far as like, you know, claim, like how big do claims get? What anything in the numbers that sort of jumps out that you think would be of interest to the listeners?
I mean, I think the important thing to remember with claims when you're talking about damages or settlements is that it really isn't reflective of the size of the firm or company. You know, a lot of these claims have an emotional distress component. So a lot of smaller employers feel that, well, you know, they're a small company, they couldn't get hit with a large verdict or have to have a large settlement. But that's not necessarily the case, particularly when you're looking at sexual harassment and other types of claims like that. So I think that's really an important, you know, piece of all of this.
And I, in a recent interview I did with Rebecca Toffolon, one of the things we talked about was this concept of a pain period, which is kind of from the time a claim is made until it's ultimately resolved. You know, the firm has to deal with it. Basically, the firm has to apply resources to it, in a number of different ways. And I could see, especially if it were a claim around sexual harassment or whatnot, that would really be magnified, with an emotional element as well. So it's really not just about the damages, is it?
No, not at all. And keep in mind, too, when you're talking about harassment, you know, one of the things that an employer has to do when they become aware of allegations of harassment is to conduct a prompt and thorough investigation. And you really need to have someone trained in that area. So you're either going to have someone in-house who's highly trained, or you're going to have to go out and retain an attorney or someone else who is trained in investigations. And unfortunately, a lot of firms, especially on the smaller side, may not understand that, may not even be aware of that. And they may try to either brush it off off, or, you know, hope it goes away, or tell people they got to figure out a way to work with each other. And that can be one of the most dangerous things to do. And I'm sure, Tim, I'm sure you see this all the time.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, you know, when an internal complaint comes in, and I don't care what size employer you are, when an internal complaint comes in, that should be the thing that comes to the top of your pile. Because if you address it adequately at the onset, you can nip it in the bud and prevent the potential claim from growing. Maybe we can avoid going to litigation. Maybe we can avoid having that employee go out of house, file an administrative complaint, seek a plaintiff's attorney. Maybe we can avoid all of that. Because look, if you don't, and if sometimes litigation can be unavoidable, but if you get there, the cost of a litigation is not just the dollars and cents that you're going to wind up paying to your defense counsel. There's an emotional component on an employer. There's morale problems. There's a sweat equity problem, because it's not as if your lawyer will just handle everything by him or herself. You will have to be involved as well. You'll have to assign resources to address the problem on a going forward basis.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And I like that the term you pointed out, a potential claim. You know, ideally you address something before it becomes a claim, and definitely before it becomes a lawsuit. You know, anything that is a potential claim needs to be treated. It needs to be, like you said, go to the top of the pile, because you can basically, like you said, nip it in the bud. So I think that's really good advice, is to treat potential claims as extremely urgent and important, because you can prevent a lot of ramifications later on. So when things do progress, though, and they do become do end up in litigation, are we talking like relatively big damage awards? So Tim, like, what have you seen out there? Like, what sort of, for firms that haven't had any real exposure to this, you know, and we're kind of telling them they need to protect themselves, but like, how bad can it get? What do claims, what do payouts look like?
I mean, look, they certainly can get very, very bad. You know, when we talk about payouts, you know, that could be anything from a jury verdict to a private settlement. And, you know, for a lot of these types of claims, it's almost essentially a mathematical computation, right? You know, under statute, you look at what the plaintiff could be entitled to, and there's an economic damages component, things like lost wages. So if we look at a standard termination claim, and an allegation of, oh, I got fired because of my fill in the blank, whatever the protected category is. I've been out of work for a year, year and a half. Okay, well, what was the person's salary? And, you know, times that by one and a half. But the biggest problem there is the emotional damages component. Mm-hmm. You know, because emotional damages awards can be done on a sliding scale. There's anything from, you know, what people in the business call garden variety emotional damages. Those are the things like the stereotypical, oh, you know, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't eat, I was so upset. You know, the thing that any one of us would deal with if, and you know, we wind up losing our jobs. And garden variety emotional distress damages can be high. I mean, I'm a practitioner here in New York, and there's a couple of cases out there that indicate that a six-figure garden variety emotional distress damages award is feasible. But that number gets, you know, increased even higher if that plaintiff seeks help. They treat with a physician, or they treat with a mental health professional. Suddenly that number increases overall. And the other piece of the, you know, overall component that you look at when you look at these claims is attorney's fees. And now I'm not just talking about the fees that an employer would spend to defend. A lot of these laws and statutes that are in place regarding employment discrimination and harassment, they're fee shifting, meaning that either in a settlement or in a verdict, the employer would also be paying the plaintiff's attorney's fees. And I'm sure you can imagine how a plaintiff's attorney will say that they've worked many, many hours on a case, no matter what level you're at.
Sure. No, and I, you know, so I think you're talking about if it does end up going to a trial and whatnot, like you said, six figure. And then if you kind of add in attorney's fees and emotional damage where they've consulted with physicians and whatnot, you know, even into seven figures. So that's some that's some big numbers that you definitely you don't want to ever play in that space if there's a way to get ahead of it.
Absolutely. And then in certain cases, even punitive damages can be provided, which, you know, punitive damages are punishment damages. And, you know, I would imagine, you know, Laura would be able to comment on that from an insurance component, but those are the types of damages and those are the types of numbers that keep me up at night.
Okay. I think you're right, Tim. I had a little bit of a hard time hearing you there, so I'll just kind of recap. You're talking about, you know, and there's also punitive or punishment damages, which can really take the number up. You know, that's where the court is attempting to set an example, I guess, to basically say, look, we don't want to see this kind of behavior again from your company, and there's one way to really get someone's attention, get a company's attention is to punish them over and above just what, the kind of the garden variety that you were talking about. Would you say you group things into, you know, there are potential claims that you as the insurance, firm, there's kind of potential claims, there's claims, and then there's, when it goes to litigation, are those kind of the three categories that you work with?
Well, it's really different. You really have to look at the definitions that are in the particular policy. So there is a definition for potential claims. What I deal with primarily, though, are helping our policyholders even before that, trying to give them the resources so that they understand, you know, what the issues are, so that they understand why documentation is important, so that they understand how to handle all these things when they come up. That's really where my focus is primarily.
This whole idea of prevention and the fact that there are resources available, I think, is good news for the listeners of you know, growing organizations, growing firms. It kind of that makes me think about how kind of easy and natural it is for a successful small to medium sized company, you know, to maintain their great culture and have effective internal communication, but then how those two things can really become a challenge when there's rapid growth at the firm. You know, things that were once kind of easy and taken for granted now need to be part of the plan to maintain kind of their culture and the way things work, and to ensure healthy, sustainable growth going forward.
Absolutely. And that's where training really comes in. And Tim mentioned it before, you know, there are some state laws now that require anti-harassment training, but that's just the beginning. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of companies, including, you know, CPA firms, look at it as this is what I have to do and that's it. It's really just the beginning. And training on all types of discrimination prevention, all types of harassment prevention. Remember, we talk about sexual harassment a lot. That's what's been in the news with the Me Too movement. But there's racial harassment. There's harassment on, you know, other types of protected bases. So it's really important that employees and managers are all trained in the prevention of all these types of discrimination and harassment. And then you really have to also provide training to your managers so they know how to handle issues as they arise. So all of this is really very important.
So kind of knowing the potential risks with EPL liability for growing firms, what would you suggest firm leaders do to decrease the risk and keep their growth and success on track? You mentioned a few things, but anything else, like in general advice you would give to the leaders of these firms?
Well, you know, one of the things to consider is the purchase of employment practices liability insurance. And in addition to the coverage that you get through an EPL policy, many carriers, particularly CNA, provide resources that can help you manage the risk. So if a firm purchases EPL from CNA, we offer complimentary access to our online web platform, Beyond HR. We provide online anti-harassment and anti-discrimination training free of charge. But there's also a lot of articles, podcasts, information there. Employment law is changing so rapidly, and it's very difficult for someone who's not, you know, in human resources to really, you know, understand all of the different ramifications of the changes in the laws. By having this online platform, it helps, you know, for our policyholders to stay abreast of all the different changes. We also provide a hotline for our policyholders where they can speak directly with an employment practices liability attorney to get advice on certain issues. We provide a phone consultation of up to 30 minutes per month or 6 hours per year. So, you know, in addition to the purchase of the policy itself, there are a lot of risk management type of resources that are provided that are available.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I think that's good news for companies for firms that are just sort of hitting that threshold to where maybe it's time that they consider their first EPL policy for the firm, or perhaps they have something and they need to enhance it. That it really can come with a variety of resources that they really should have anyway at the firm in order to do these kind of trainings and whatnot. Anything you can add, Tim, about the way a firm can maybe set the tone at the top to prevent litigation down the road?
Sure. I mean, in my experience, the most successful firms, the ones that really are able to avoid claims, they're the ones that take these issues seriously. It starts at the top. If you as a principal in an organization take these issues seriously and do what you're supposed to do, do your due diligence, do your training, properly relay messages to your managers, make sure that they're taking it seriously. There's a trickle down effect, and on top of just the overall adequate training that you're going to need. When issues arise in the workplace, and they will, because we're social creatures by nature, and sometimes things go awry. If any organization they address it appropriately, they do their proper investigation, they address any and all issues, they follow up with their employees to make sure that everything is fine. That's a perfect situation, because at that point, the principal of the company is not just pitching to that one employee who's having the issue, because employees talk. They're pitching to everybody. So if you handle a problem adequately from the onset, it's a message to the rest of your staff. Hey, look, this place takes these issues seriously. This is the type of place that I want to work. This is the type of place that's going to be successful. And that pays off in dividends.
Now, that really does make sense. And, kind of setting that tone at the top regarding, maintenance of a non-discriminatory and safe workplace, I can see how staff and even the partners, that they'll absorb that and they'll emulate what they see and hear from their boss, from the managing partner or the partner heading a particular practice. So I think that is really important. And one element we didn't really talk about too much, we didn't really talk about directly here is kind of reputation risk. The fact that if there are issues and if things are not handled in a professional way, that's going to get out one way or another. That's going to get out to industry. It's going to get out to clients, potential clients. And for companies that are growing, that's going to get out to potential employees. When you're trying to hire, to establish or to basically execute on your growth plan. If there are issues like this that we've talked about here that were not prevented, that were not addressed when they did happen, that's really going to hurt your reputation, and it's going to make the execution of that growth plan even harder. So while we wrap up here, any particular resources you would recommend for firms? I'll start with you, Laura.
I think it's important to have a connection, with an employment law firm. I think, like Tim's firm, there are a lot of resources online that can be really helpful. In addition, if you do purchase EPL, to take advantage of the resources that are provided. The EEOC on their website, eeoc.gov, has some information for small businesses that small firms can take advantage of that can be helpful as well.
Okay. And Tim, any resources that you would recommend for firms?
Yeah, but whichever counsel you wind up working with, they're going to be able to provide you information, keep you up on current trends. Just by way of example, I can tell you that on our website, jacksonlewis.com, we have entire sections of articles and blog posts that get pushed out immediately once there's a change in the law, or there's a new case, or new guidance from one of these agencies like the EEOC or the DOL. Staying abreast of these topics and getting out ahead of them is the most important thing that you can do.
Okay, great stuff. Great stuff. So great advice, everyone. And the numbers we sort of talked about, I think, back up the importance of what we talked about. I'll also add that, like we said, setting the tone at the top in this important area will likely bolster the efforts to maintain a great firm culture as a firm grows. So I'd like to thank our guests for joining us today and for helping firms as they innovate and transform to better serve their clients. Thank you very, very much for joining us today, Laura and Tim.
Thank you.
Great. Thanks. Hey, we hope you gleaned some useful, actionable insights from today's podcast. I'm Stephen Menges with CPA.com, and I want to thank you all for listening today. Quick reminder, the show notes provide links to great additional content related to today's topic, so check them out, along with all of the Modernizing Your Practice content, which can be found at cpa.com/MYP. Until next time, I encourage you all to also check out the Go Beyond Disruption podcast for a unique global insight type look for accounting firms on emerging technology, human intelligence, and digital transformation. Again, thank you to our guests and take care.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of CPA.com. It is provided with the understanding that CPA.com is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. CPA.com makes no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assume no responsibility for, the content and application of the material contained herein, and expressly disclaim all liability for such damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.